Mr. James, good morning to you, and Ms. Faust, good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin? Then, Mr. James, you may approach and you may proceed.
There are a few things here that I'm going to point out are not in dispute. First of all, there is no dispute that based on Judge Illingworth's findings from the April 15th, 2021 hearing, that speedy trial had run by the time the matter came on for trial. There's also no dispute that Judge Illingworth made findings concerning speedy trial when he ruled on the state's motion to continue. And there's no dispute that the basis for the continuance, which was presented at the time of the motion for continuance, or the hearing on the motion to continue, and the hearing on the motion for discharge, was the same basis there. What is unusual about this case is that we have two different judges due to retirement of Judge Illingworth and a successor judge in Judge Harder redoing essentially findings that were already made by Judge Illingworth at the hearing on the motion to continue, which begs the question of how you can have two different findings on the same set of facts. And I think
before you get too far into that, I want to discuss section 29-1207-4A. Are you familiar with 4A?
I am.
And I believe I'm sure you've read the state's brief and how that would apply. Can you explain to us how your position could get around that exclusion of time?
Well, I think that's why I pointed out in my brief that you have to look at the Williams case and Turner and the most recent one, Carrera, I believe is how you pronounce it, where the court is, and Carrera is a good example of how the court looked at the time. In fact, it was under the exact same situation where they had a pending motion to suppress, and there was continuances, and the court focused in on that language from Williams about the presumption that there's a presumption that the delay is attributable to the defendant unless the record affirmatively indicates otherwise. And it's that point about the delay there that I think doesn't render all time under 29-1207-4A excludable automatically. There's still that presumption built in for the court to consider that there can be those situations where if the record affirmatively indicates otherwise, that time or delay would count against the state.
I understand the statement about the case law that you're referring to. Is there anything in the statute, the language of that particular provision of the statute, that would support your argument?
Well, I think that's how the courts have construed the statute, and I, if you're talking about the plain meaning of the statute, I think that there's been case law that's interpreted that statute that's been around since the Turner case, which I believe was in the 90s. So I think that's how the courts have construed it up to this point, and that's how we've been construing the statute, Your Honor.
Isn't the heart of your argument that the findings that Judge Illingworth made are attributed some finality vis-a-vis a successor judge, and that the successor judge cannot take a different view? Isn't that the heart of your argument?
I think, in a sense, yes. When you think about the fact that Judge Illingworth, in making his decision on the continuance, would have had to have made findings of fact, he's thinking about this. He acknowledged on the record that he read the state's motion. It was a very detailed motion. I think it was 13 paragraphs that outlined all the reasons why the state was requesting the continuance. Again, the same reasons that were presented at the motion for discharge hearing. But when you're talking about finality, it's not in a sense a final order. However, the fact is that Judge Illingworth ruled on the continuance and in doing that, he'd made those findings. I don't see how Judge Harder had the authority to go back and redo findings. I think what she hung her hat on was
Judge Illingworth, if he were still on the bench, had the option to go back and change his opinion on this issue?
Well, it's hypothetical. I don't know. Knowing Judge Illingworth, you probably know him pretty well. I don't know that he'd go back and change any decision he'd already made. But the point
happens, we said in numerous cases, that no judge is required to persist in error, and that consequently, if the successor judge determines that the first judge was erroneous, the successor judge has control of the case.
I don't know that she clearly said he was erroneous. I think that in the state's brief, they said she implicitly disagreed with Judge Illingworth's findings, but I don't think there was any error. And when you're talking, and it's more of an appellate issue, I think, too, is if you're looking back, it's on a motion to continue, absent a showing of abuse of discretion, the motion to continue would not be disturbed on appeal. But
excuse me, did the set of facts that form the basis for the calculation change from when Judge Illingworth ruled to when Judge Harder ruled?
The facts did not change. I mean, they're essentially the same.
Time marches on. Doesn't that implicate a different calculation?
I'm not quite clear what you're getting at, but time marches on.
Judge Illingworth ran the numbers at a certain point in time, right? And under a certain set of facts, motions were filed and so forth.
Correct.
Right. Were the facts identical when Judge Harder took this up?
Well, yeah, they would have been, yes.
Didn't the state offer additional evidence at the hearing on the motion for discharge?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because I think what Judge Harder really hung her hat on was the fact that there was, quote-unquote, no evidence presented at the hearing on the motion to continue.
But there was a state request for a transcript. Is that right, or I misunderstand the record?
There was a state request for the transcript prior
to
the
motion. With respect to the first judge's ruling.
There was a request for a transcript of a preliminary hearing that was requested before the motion to suppress was even filed. And that was that request is what the state's reasoning was for needing the continuance to use that as, quote, evidence at a suppression hearing, which I argued it clearly was not going to be evidence. In fact, it was asked or requested before the motion to suppress was even filed, because the state had said we're going to prepare, or this is needed to prepare and use for the suppression hearing. Well, the suppression motion hadn't even been filed at that point. Is that what you're referring to, is the transcript of the preliminary hearing?
I may not understand the record properly. I thought there was a request for a transcript that pertained to the previous judge's ruling.
Well, I think the transcript, I think what you're referring to, and I could be wrong, is...
Oh, I could be wrong.
I don't think there was a transcript. What we had done on the record is there was not, in the journal entry from the hearing on the motion to continue, and I wanted to get back to your point, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Well, the questions are related. Just different math?
No, at the hearing on the motion to continue, the judge ordered the state to journalize. And as a part of his findings, he said the speedy trial time continues to run. That never got memorialized in the journal entry by the state. So what
but Judge Harder was aware of that when she made her decision. Is that correct?
Well, I hope she was. She did acknowledge that she was aware of it in her, but I made it.
But you talked about it in the hearing. Is that correct?
Extensively. And
in front of her.
I did.
She was present at the hearing. So we assume if she heard it, she was there, she was aware of it, even though she didn't recognize it in her order.
Right.
She was aware of it.
I think what, going back to what she did that we need to look at or focus on, is the fact that she sort of took the position, what seems to me, is that there was no quote-unquote evidence presented in the motion to continue. And this court has consistently held, I think it was in Roundtree, in Bellamontes, and other cases, that oral statements of the prosecutor absent an objection from the defendant are going to be sufficient for a judge to determine whether or not a motion to continue should be granted.
Of course, we, in all of those cases, said it's not a good idea to do that.
Exactly, and I agree with that. But in this case, I find myself arguing on the other side of that, because Judge Illingworth had those specific reasons set before him in a very detailed motion and made findings that we maintain Judge Harder could not redo. And the fact that there was...
What if Judge Harder just disagreed?
Well, I don't... It seems to me an odd situation where you would have a trial court disagree with the prior ruling of the court, especially when parties are relying on that.
We have motions for reconsideration that get filed all the time, right? Whole system is premised on giving the judge opportunity to change their mind.
I don't think a motion for discharge is the same as a motion for reconsideration, and not an appropriate motion to go back and try to reevaluate a previous finding of the court. I don't think that's...
When is the appropriate time to calculate excluded time? Isn't it at the filing of a motion for discharge? I mean, that's when the defendant is asserting that his or her speedy trial rights have been violated, and we have to do the math.
It is, but when you're looking back at the record and what the prior rulings were, which the parties are all relying on as they go forward, and the state was put on notice as to when speedy trial ran because by Judge Illingworth's calculations, it had already run by the time the trial had come. So
we circle back to my original question, which was, your position is dependent upon the notion that Judge Harder did not have authority to change what Judge Illingworth did.
In a sense, yes, because I don't think she could go back and change the findings that were already made on the record.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Stacey Faust. I'm an assistant attorney general representing the Appalachian State of Nebraska in this matter. There appears to be two primary issues in this case. One is, was Judge Harder, who heard and ruled on Nelson's motion for discharge, bound by Judge Illingworth's finding that the speedy trial clock ran 42 days for the state's continuance? And two, if not, what is the applicable speedy trial subsection to exclude that time under? The state's position is that Judge Harder was not bound by Judge Illingworth's finding and that the applicable subsection is 4A. Judge Harder was not bound by Judge Illingworth's finding because it was not final. I think it was, as Chief Justice pointed out, it was a ruling that Judge Illingworth could have changed himself throughout the course of the proceedings. And moreover, the speedy trial finding that he did make was not even necessary unless and until Nelson filed a motion for discharge. And after Nelson filed that motion, it was Judge Harder, not Judge Illingworth, who heard the motion, heard the evidence on it, and ruled on it. And she correctly excluded the time based on the evidence before her.
Would it be accurate to describe Judge Illingworth's opining upon the speedy trial effect of the continuance as an advisory opinion?
Yes. I don't think it wasn't ripe for decision at that point until the motion for discharge
was filed.
Could
it have been appealed at that point?
No. No motion for discharge had been filed. Now, Judge Harder excluded it was dicta. And really, I read the record as, frankly, the state's asked to continue it, so time's running until we actually have a hearing on this motion. That's how I read it. He didn't ever give a reason. There was no evidence offered. There was no evidence on the state's motion offered until at the motion for discharge hearing, and that was in the form of the prosecutor's affidavit.
That advisory opinion, is that consistent with 29-1207 sub 4 sub A?
No, not in my opinion.
And why not?
Because this court, an excludable period under subsection 4A began as soon as Nelson filed his suppression motion. And an excludable period under 4A does not end until disposition of that motion. Obviously, that motion was still pending when the state moved to continue the hearing on it. And as this court has said numerous times, the plain meaning of subsection 4A does not have a reasonableness, due diligence, or a good cause requirement. The state doesn't have to make any showing for the time due to a defendant's pretrial motion to be excludable under 4A beyond, I guess, offering or asking judicial notice of the motion itself and the order ruling on it.
I beg your pardon, how many decisions did we have that we're looking at? Was Judge Illingworth opining a decision?
No, I don't. I think
so
it
we
was
have
a
one,
finding.
So we have only one. We have only one decision, and a record of evidence on that one decision.
Yes, and it's Judge Harder's decision.
The appellant contends that he relied upon Judge Illingworth's decision, statement, advisory opinion, dicta, whatever you want to call it. What impact does that reliance have?
I don't think it has any impact because his argument assumed that, I guess, that finding has some type of preclusion effect, and he hasn't met any of the preclusion elements. I mean, the whole point of the speedy trial statute is to ensure that defendants get their right to speedy trial, and he would have had that on November 8th, but instead he chose to file a premature motion for discharge.
So no claim preclusion, anything of that nature?
Doesn't fit here.
I have a question on the factual issues. It's probably completely irrelevant to ultimately what decides this case. What does the record tell us about the transcript that was involved here and whether or not the defense attorney wouldn't give the transcript back to the What do we know about that?
Right. So the reason for the state wanting the continuance on the suppression hearing was because it had not received, the prosecutor had not received the preliminary hearing transcript of the testimony of its sole material witness that it needed for the suppression hearing, which was the arresting officer. And so it had, the prosecutor had requested the preliminary transcript from the county court clerk, and the county court clerk mistakenly delivered it to opposing counsel. When the error was discovered, I'm assuming when the prosecutor started preparing for the suppression hearing, and I don't have my preliminary hearing transcript, called the county court clerk, and the county court clerk said, oh, whoops, I accidentally delivered it to defense counsel. Defense counsel was contacted, and he refused to return it. So the county court clerk had to prepare another preliminary hearing transcript, and it was not going to be done in time for the suppression hearing. And I guess that brings me back to one of my other points of not only was, is a subsection 4A because it was Nelson's pretrial motion that was filed. I mean, that should be enough to exclude this time under 4A. But it also, the delay also definitively relates back to the defendant's act or conduct, which is required for the time to be excluded under 4A, because it was defense counsel who was really the reason for the continuance. It's contacted for the preliminary hearing transcript that the prosecutor said he needed to be prepared for the suppression hearing on the defendant's motion, and defense counsel was said, no, I'm not going to give it back. So, once again, it relates back to the defendant's act of conduct.
Does this court or the Court of Appeals have case law that's inconsistent or in tension with your plain language argument based on 4A?
Yes. So I cited that case law in my brief. It is the Court of Appeals case law. And there's a couple cases there, one of which is Carrera that opposing counsel cited too, where the defendant was given the benefit of this a continuance on his own suppression motion because the state didn't meet the elements under 4CI or 4CII for the time due to its continuance on the defendant's motion to be excluded. And that's just wrong. We don't look at other subsections once an excludable period has already started under 4A due to a defendant's pretrial motion.
There's no cases from this court you're aware of where we've endorsed that sort of looking at 4C while a 4A motion is pending.
No, not that I'm aware of. And so
what do we need to do in your opinion?
Disapprove of this Court of Appeals cases so that they are not in conflict with this court's case law. That cites or sets forth the plain meaning of 4A doesn't have a reasonableness or a due diligence or a good cause requirement because by analyzing those other subsections, that's exactly what that is doing. If there are no further questions.
Right. I didn't write any of those Court of Appeals decisions you're asking.
No, you're on the one I actually cited that I like. It was Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, that concludes arguments in State versus Nelson. Thank you very much, and you are excused. And the next case of the day, then, is State versus Lewis.